I want to know God in this lifetime, in this body. I want to know God. I want to know the joy that He is within me. And I will tell you unequivocally, no man has brought me closer to Him than my Guru, Paramahansa Yogananda. And no man has brought me closer to my Guru than my dear friend and teacher that sits in front of me, Swami Kriyananda. I want to know God. And you, more than anyone living, have taught me God. Your example, your love, your friendship, has given me a glimpse of the God that is within me. And I hope that every one of you get an opportunity in this lifetime to know God. And I hope that every one of you, even for a moment, can know the joy that I've known by knowing Swami Kriyananda and the Ananda family that means so much to me. You're all here tonight because of Swami Kriyananda. You're in this temple built from his vision and his love. I couldn't have possibly even conceived moving to Encinitas, being a channel for this divine grace, or meeting all of you. It would be literally impossible. But it's an example of how we can know God when we're open and we allow His grace to flow through us. I can't possibly repay you, Swamiji. But I can dedicate this temple to you and to our Guru, Paramahansa Yogananda. This temple of joy, which has brought so much to me and my beloved wife and every one of you that's here today. We're all here because of Swami Kriyananda, because of the family that he's created, the sense of community that we all feel here tonight. And it's brought us just a step closer to God. Thank you, my friend. Namaste. Bless you. You didn't come here to listen to me. I didn't come here to talk. I want to thank you all for being here. I do want to let you know a couple of things. The bathroom is right here, to the left, if you need to use it. Food on the table at the end of the evening. Your donations are graciously accepted. It will go to serve this work. And every Wednesday we gather here at 7, and you're all welcome to join us. And of course, anytime, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, we encourage you to know God. And this sacred space that you're in is available to help you in even the smallest way. This temple never closes. This is here for you. Come anytime, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and come closer to God. Now I'd like to welcome our friend and the most saintly man I know in the physical form today, Swami Kriyananda, who can come up and share with us some of his wisdom.
I'm very happy to be here tonight. I would like to add that of the many introductions I have had in my life, this was perhaps the most beautiful. Thank you. I'm here to talk about how to be happy all the time.
It's not as easy a subject as you might think. Because I've noticed that people have everything they want are always irritable. I've noticed that some of the happiest people I've met are people who don't have anything. Happiness is our birthright, but it's something we have to labor for. It's not easy. Why do we want happiness? The first question is that one. It is that we are all made from the same bliss. God has been best defined through all eternity as Satchidananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. My guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, added that last definition to Satchidananda, ever new. The wonderful thing about it is that in eternal and divine bliss, every moment is different. Every person's way of expressing that bliss is different. It's an incredible thing. I had a dream about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, it was in Florence in Italy. And I saw many, many, many different people of all different types, some of them very sour looking, some of them happy looking, some of them looking somewhat criminal. But I saw that all of them, each one, was seeking the same thing. Everybody in this world wants happiness. Everyone in this world really wants bliss. The nature of God is bliss. He didn't create us. He manifested us. We're a part of Him. We're as much a part of Him as Jesus Christ was, or Buddha, or Yogananda, or any great master. We're as close to God as they are. The difference between them and us lies only in the knowing. So the worst sin, as Yogananda often said, is to call yourself a sinner. I remember when I was young, I was only 21, so you can't say that the habit of smoking was strong in me, but it was strong enough to be difficult. And I decided that I needed to become a hermit, and that I needed to seek God, and that was the goal of my life. And the first thing I thought was, well, if I'm a hermit, where would I get cigarettes? And so I decided, okay, I've got to give up smoking. Well, I found that it was the easiest thing in the world to give up, just as Mark Twain said. He said, I've done it 1,000 times. The trouble was that I kept going back to it. But I found a very important key in this process. Because every time I slipped and went back to it, I said to myself, I have not yet succeeded. I didn't say I failed. I said I have not yet succeeded. Never identify yourself with your weaknesses. Never identify yourself with any wrong that you have done. We have all done wrong in this world. That's why we're here. But we're trying to get out of it, and the way to get out of it is to say that that is not I. There are two aspects to religion. One is the all-embracing one, but along with that there has to be the rejecting one. It's like a story I often tell of an American soldier in boot camp during World War II who used to go around picking up paper off the ground, and he'd say, this isn't it, this isn't it, this isn't it. Finally, they thought, well, this guy needs to be sent to the camp psychiatrist. And he went, and instead of talking to the psychiatrist, he kept picking papers off his desk. Now, this isn't it. This isn't it. Finally, the psychiatrist recommended him for medical discharge. And he got that medical discharge and said, "This is it." And he ran out of there gleefully. Well, this is what we have to understand, that we do need to give up certain things. But this negative aspect of religion is also has an unfortunate side, because in this, people tend to reject other people. People say, "You're following Jesus Christ the way I'm not. There's something wrong with you." Or, "You're following Yogananda, but not my way. There's something wrong with you." And so I have had to endure a lot of persecution in my life. And I have to say that if you want to be happy all the time, learn how to enjoy being unhappy. Base in your life all those things which you think might make you unhappy or miserable. I remember I said to Dr. and Mrs. Lewis, it was here in Encinitas many years ago, but I said, "I've seen so many monks leaving, Master, and I said, one thing that I am doing to help me to be firm and never leave is to develop a deep attachment to SRF, a deep attachment to living here. You know, that was the one thing God took from me. I was the vice president. I had a very high position. I was in charge of all the monks. And I was summoned from India to New York, of all places, 3,000 miles away. And I was told that I was out, and absolutely out. We never want to see you again. We want to forget that you ever lived. We want nothing more to do with you." And I said, "But what you're saying is all wrong. There's nothing true in it. We don't need your opinions." It was the most unbelievable encounter of my life. I was thrown out into the streets with nothing but the money in my pockets. And I had to make my own way from there. I look back over my life, and I think of all the blessings I have had, that one was the greatest. You will be amazed to see how those very things that you most dread are the very greatest tragedies that may come to you. If you accept them, if you try as I did, don't react. Don't hate people for hating you. Don't blame people for blaming you. Just say, "I love everyone." And I had a very selfish reason for loving them. I found I was happier if I would love them. I was not happy if I didn't. And so I decided it didn't matter how they treated me. I would love them. I always have loved them. But I have not been welcome here in Encinitas just for this reason. I was very much a part of SRF. I was completely attached to it, and God took that away from me too. Yet, look what I have been able to accomplish since then. I'm grateful for it. No, it was not an easy experience. It was a very, very painful experience. I was deeply hurt. They had not understood my motives. They had not understood where I was coming from. But I don't blame anybody. I say it was my best good karma to be put in a position where I could do what Master himself had told me to do. He told me to write. He told me to edit. He told me to lecture. And although he didn't tell me to create communities, yet this was something that was a necessary part of what I did do to help build his work and to help spread his message. It's an interesting thing, but at the age of 15, already I was thinking seriously of creating communities. And I got all my friends enthusiastic until they found I was serious. Then they all dropped off. But I never lost that interest. When I found that Master wanted to create one, I knew this is what I had to do too. And at that lecture in Hollywood, I was at the Myers Garden Party in 1949. And this master stood up, usually after a garden party, the person for whom you're giving this in honor, you thank the person when he's asked to speak, will say, well, thank you, and be very gracious to the guests, and thank you for coming, it's been a wonderful day, wonderful to meet all of you. Some sort of nice, pleasant compliment.
Boy, it was not that at all.
I have never heard such a powerful lecture in my life. He said, this day marks the beginning of a new era, and my words are registered in the ether, and they shall not die. And then he urged thousands of youths to go north and south and east and west, everywhere, to spread this idea of cooperative communities, or as he called them, small world brotherhood colonies. I have had the good fortune to be able to build 8 such communities in my lifetime. Who knows how many, but I'll tell you there's one advantage to old age. It doesn't last. Anyway, I can say this, that, you know, it was here in Encinitas that Master tried to start communities. He got land here. He had married people living there. It wasn't the time. Many things that he tried to do, he wanted to do, it was very important for him to do, but he knew that it wouldn't work then. It would just show that he was serious about doing it. And later on, when the time came, he tried to start a school. He failed. Mount Washington originally was intended to be a school. But of course it didn't remain, didn't become that. First of all, you need to convert the parents before they'll send their children. He was new in this country. Yet he tried to do it. And when he failed in that, it didn't mean he failed. It mean he simply hadn't, it wasn't the right time. And in those days, in the late 40s, people were still struggling out of the Great Depression. And they were saying that we, us four and no more. They were thinking of the security of their own little families. There wasn't the same dedication that you find today. I have been lecturing now. The first time he had me lecture was in San Diego. It was quite an experience for me. I met him when I was 22. I was still only 22 when he had me lecture. I'd only been with him 8 months. And I was the one, so I knew what was happening, who sent in the announcements to the newspapers to say that which lecture, which minister would be talking in which church. I knew he hadn't come to San Diego for 2 months. And the people had been told to look at the announcements in the paper, and when you see that I'm coming, then I will be coming. And so I sent in the announcement under instructions to do so, to put his name in the paper. And I thought, those happy people, how wonderful it will be. Saturday morning, news came to me that Master wasn't going. He wanted me to go in his place. 22, you know, it's not very, very mature age. And I had to give Kriya initiation afterwards to one person, but that scared me even more. I'd only attended one initiation. I'd never lectured before in my life. I think the greatest blessing I had was I was so sorry for all these poor people who had to face me instead of Master, that I didn't have time to be sorry for myself. I was just too nervous for them. But it was an occasion, I must tell you. The curtains used to be closed, and then when they were opened, there the minister was. And the curtains opened. Instead of seeing Master, they saw this little 22-year-old. And it must have been quite a shock. The church was absolutely packed. Standing room at the back, people peering in the windows, people crowding in the parking lot outside, trying to hear what they could. We didn't have a loudspeaker. And here was little me. I think it was perhaps the shortest talk I've ever given, but I did my humble best. It showed their spiritual development that nobody got up and walked out. It was really I have to say, it's like throwing the chick out of the nest. Not letting him practice flying, just go and fly. But from then on, Master had me lecturing, and he told me my life would be lecturing. He often said to me, I remember I was standing with Herbert Fried, who was being sent to Phoenix to be the minister there. And Master was in the car and we were about to go out for a ride. And he was giving Herbert some last minute advice. And he said several things. And then he said, you have a great work to do. And I turned to Herbert thinking naturally he was talking to Herbert. And I wanted to felicitate him. Master said, it's you I'm talking to, Walter. He used to call me Walter. I mean, it seems strange, but hey, we called me Walter. It wasn't my name. James Donald Walters was my real name. Anyway, from then on, many times, but always in private, he said to me, you have a great work to do. One time he said to me, of all the men, except for St. Lynn, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me. And he spoke with so much force. And I wondered what he meant, because I knew he had spiritual men disciples. But what he meant was that it's male nature to go out there and reach people and try to help people. The male organ is even outside. It's the masculine nature to want to go out, the feminine nature to want to come in. It's just human nature everywhere. And he knew that for his work really to spread, a male nature was needed. When I was thrown out, I was the only man on the board of directors. I was the only one who had tried to do creative things to build the work. I suppose there was jealousy there, I don't know. Not my business to worry about other people's motives. But I do know that when I read Autobiography of a Yogi back in September of 1948, and I took the next bus across the country to meet Master, and the first words I said to him when I met him were, I want to be your disciple. I had never had any intention, any thought, even a hint that I would ever be anybody's disciple. I don't know if I was arrogant or if I just never met anybody that I thought that knew anything. But as soon as I read Autobiography of a Yogi, I knew this man is what I wanted. The first words I said to him were, I want to be your disciple. But as I was coming across the country, my thought was, I'm going to meet my guru. I'm going to be accepted by him. I must be accepted by him. And I'm going to give my life to God. But there was another thought there too. I said, this mission, this message is so wonderful, the whole world should know about it. And I came to him with this intense desire that all humanity get this message and be changed by it. I know, I have always known it was a totally impractical desire, but I can't help it. I have it. I really want everybody in the world to know who he really is. He's a child of God. This has been the only motive behind the 140 books that I've written, the over 400 pieces of music, the 15,000 photographs, the 8 communities, all these different things. Somebody said to me in a radio interview recently, how have you done so much? And my answer was, I did it by not doing it. And that has been the secret. How could I do so much by not doing it? By letting him do it. Most people say, well then, if God is the doer, let it be. You know, I tried this as an experiment once. I was in the Hollywood church. And I remember that Master had said that you should let God talk through you. So I thought, well, let me try an experiment. I'll just shut up and let God talk. So Mind you, 100 people in the audience. And all of a sudden, the speaker stops speaking. What are you going to think? People are perspiring, thinking I'd frozen with fear. No, I was standing quite comfortably waiting for God to talk. After 2 minutes, 2 minutes of silence, that's quite a long time. I finally decided that Master had said, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. And I found that, yes, I have to do it, but he has to do it through me. And in that spirit, I say, in all sincerity, I have done all these things by not doing them. If I want to write a song, then I simply say to God, I want the song to say this, this, and this. Give me a melody. And it's there. I don't have to work for it. Nothing I've worked for has taken any trouble. You know, the whole, when I worked with him on the interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, I was with him during that time. I helped him a little bit, and some of the archives show my editorial changes or suggestions. And it was a very meaningful thing to do. I said to him, Master, this is the most wonderful thing I've ever read. And I remember one day, Master said that the book will be out by December of this year. This was 1950. And I had to take the mail over to Tara, Lori Pratt, who was the main editor. And I said to her that Master says the book will be out by December of this year. Oh, not possibly. So I went back to Master and told her what she'd said, that it wouldn't be possible this year. I was acting in good faith. But Master said, delays, delays, always delays. And he said, I'm going to write her a note. You take it to her. Yeah. Naturally, I thought that his note would be a scolding. So when I gave her the note, I said, I'm sorry, it's my fault, I didn't mean to. Well, he didn't give her a scolding, he didn't say anything, but she knew what I meant because she wasn't dumb. And it caused a serious trouble between them. Master gave me a good scolding for that. But I think anybody in my position would have thought that's what Master's note was really about. Anyway, how long did it take that book to come out? 45 years. It didn't come out until 1995, I think it was. And when it did, it was such a disappointment to me. It had none of the original inspiration. It had none of the original clarity. It made spiritual mistakes. It said, for example, that if your nature is dark, here's what you can do to change it. Well, the trouble with a dark nature, a tamasic nature, is one above all that you don't want to change. How are you going to change? It's not because you want to. You did it through the company, through suffering, through anything. But there were several serious mistakes. The point is that I was extremely disappointed. And one time I had a dream, and I said to Master in the dream, Sir, I want so much to see this book come out the way I remember it. And what can I do? I can't get into their archives. I'm not welcome there. I'm not welcome here tonight by them. It shouldn't be. We love the same guru. We love the same God. We love the same truths. Why should there be this difference? I have no ill will against them. I have not done a single thing out of a spirit of rivalry or competition. I've done my best all my life not to compete with them. Whatever they were doing, to do something different so that I could still serve Master. When they told me in New York, from now on, there's nothing you can do for Master. We don't want him, we don't want anyone to know that he had such a despicable disciple as you. These were harsh words. But I decided that I don't want to compete with them. I must find new ways of serving him. Well, one, of course, was starting communities, because although he had been so keen on starting communities, I asked Diamata once in 1958, when will we start communities? And her answer was, frankly, I'm not interested. So that was fine. I decided to start communities then. And they had not written music, so I decided to write music. And I've written over 400 pieces. But this happened, it was sort of a cute story, and I'm probably going to talk a little longer than you planned. But I can't help it, there's too much to say. I was in Yosemite in the summer of 64, and I saw a couple of young men sitting on the railing of a bridge, and I felt in the mood to sing. I had studied singing as a young man, and my teacher had wanted me to become a famous singer, and I had thought, why, what is there to sing? There's nothing that I can sing that will do anything but show off my voice. I couldn't possibly mean some of those songs, the Italian song, a famous classical song, Oh, ci state di piagarmi, o lasciatemi morire, which in Italian sounds fine. Put into modern English, all it says is stop bugging me and let me die. Is this a message I wanted to give to people? I had no desire to be a singer. But I was in the mood to sing. And so I sang for these boys, and I sang Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. The only thing I could think of that would be somewhat compatible to my thinking and their thinking. And they were so thrilled with it, they said, oh, you've got to come and sing for a party tonight. And that night I went to the party and I sang Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And as I was driving home the following day, it occurred to me this would be a wonderful way to serve Master. I could see myself going around the country singing, and then I thought, but what the hell am I going to sing? I don't know any songs that say what I want to say. And then the thought came in my mind, maybe I could write my own. And all of a sudden, fully blown, this song came into my mind, a beautiful song. Words, music, everything. I stopped at a milkshake stand and wrote it down. I know how to write music, so I wrote that. And it was the start of my musical career. My brother had left his Martin guitar at my parents' home, and I learned to play the guitar. Started studying Pete Singer's Folk Singer's Guitar Guide or something like that. I'm not quite sure what the name was. But I'd been playing the guitar about a month when somebody said to me, would you like to give a concert? And I thought, well, this would be the stupidest thing I could possibly do, but at least it would force me to practice. And so for 1 week, I accepted, and for 1 week, I practiced the guitar like mad. And I went to the Unitarian Church in San Francisco, and there were about, the hall was completely full, 200 people. The lights were all turned out to give it atmosphere. The only light in the room was a candle on the mantelpiece behind me. And if there was one thing I desperately needed, it was to see those strings. And I couldn't see them at all. But anyway, the whole evening was a success. I managed to pull it off with singing. At least the song sounded good. And whatever, anyway, it launched my musical career. And so this has been another way that I've served Master. But everything I have done to serve him. I have reached out my hand repeatedly in friendship. I don't see why there can't be friendship. There should be friendship. We're all following the same cause. We all believe in basically the same teachings. I have offered even to give Ananda to SRF 2 or 3 times. Every time it's been just rejected out of hand. I tried to send donations. They were none of them accepted. Daya said, we don't want people to ask questions. I don't understand these things. But I must say this, that if you want to be happy, prepare your mind to accept the hardest blows you can possibly imagine. How are you to be happy in this world? You're not. This world is a world of duality. There can be no happiness in this world for this simple reason that everything God, in order to create the universe, had to create duality. He had to create plus and minus. It was an ocean. He had to have the troughs and the waves always alternating, so that for every sorrow, there is a joy. For every joy, there is a sorrow. For every success, there has to be a fulfillment. Nothing will ever be permanent. And if you want to be happy all the time, one of the best practices you can do is ask yourself, what is the worst thing I can possibly imagine in my life? And then say, can I accept it? If you can accept that, then you can be happy all the time. Because happiness does not come from things. It does not come from situations and other people. Happiness comes from right attitude. When you know that you are happy in yourself, then even the worst torturing. You know, there was one time Yogananda went to some sort of performance, I don't know what it was, but Miramata, she was the mother of Rinalini, who's on the board now, and she was with Master. And Master said afterwards, I noticed you looking at that girl in front of you. And she said, yes, Master, I just couldn't take my eyes off her. He said, she's been born a saint. In her last life, she died in a German concentration camp in great suffering. But her attention to other people during that suffering, her care for other people during that suffering, has made her a saint. So who can say even death in a concentration camp, even the suffering that people go through under such circumstances, who can say that they're intolerable or bad? You will have to go through many experiences. As I said earlier, I've known some people who had nothing to be unhappy about. Everything went well for them. They were always grumbling. If you can take whatever comes, good, bad, indifferent, and learn to accept it calmly and be peaceful in your own heart, you will find that then and then alone will you be able to be happy always. There's a story about Saint Teresa of Avila, one of the great saints of Spain. And she was in her old age going to found a new convent. And it was winter time and the rivers were in spate, and her horse slipped and she was taken away by the current, and her nuns thought she was drowned. And she suddenly found herself on the other bank, completely dry, and Jesus was standing there. And he said, Teresa, don't feel too badly. This is how I treat all my friends. And Teresa had a good sense of humor. And she said, oh, my Lord, that is why you have so few. Remember this. If God tests you, don't feel that he doesn't love you. He tests those he loves. Because he needs the one thing you need to do in order to know true bliss is to get out of this ego. Don't think that you are doing anything. Don't think you're responsible for anything. Just accept everything that comes to you as coming from God. And if God gives you tests, it's a sign that he loves you. Accept that test with joy. The worst thing that could come to you, imagine it. If you can imagine that and imagine yourself accepting that, then you will be happy all the time. Rather, I will say this, that you will be blissful all the time. There's a bliss that comes from inside that is just constantly there. I noticed this after my being thrown out of SRF, that although I was suffering intensely, there were a couple of occasions when I was somehow compromised into the position of having to give a lecture. And people said afterwards what they felt from me was joy. And I thought, joy, that's the one word I could not use. And yet as I looked at it more deeply, I saw that underneath it all, that joy never left me. That is the joy I'm talking about. Don't worry about happiness. Happiness because you got a nice ice cream cone, nonsense. But be happy in the love of God. Be happy in knowing that you don't exist, that He alone exists. I read the ending of a book recently by some scientist who went through what he called the dark night of the soul when he realized his ego doesn't exist. And I thought, my goodness, I don't understand how he can have such a dark night of the soul over something so obvious. And in fact, we don't exist. I know that he is the only person accomplishing anything in this world. It's his dream. We are his dream. And we are a part of the dreamer himself. Live in that way, and you will live not just happily, but blissfully, always. So now I would like to ask you, and I have talked too long, but I would like to ask you if you have any questions.
I have a question, please.
Yes.
Nice.
But mind you, I have to tell you this. There's always a defect. I'm stone deaf. So let somebody come and translate for you.
Go ahead. Thank you so much for your gift this evening. I was wondering if you have... Can you hear me okay?
I hear you.
Okay.
But if I don't, he'll tell me.
I was wondering if you have any knowledge of the person who was called the Babaji in 1970 to 1984 in India.
I don't believe it was Babaji. Several things make me think he was a different. And that's all I can say. I didn't study it, I didn't memorize it, I don't remember all my reasons, but I felt this is not genuine.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
The Bhagavad Gita you referred to by Master, is there anything written on the original?
You know what happened on that? I didn't finish the story. I said I had a dream, and then I changed the subject for some reason. I'm always doing this, so please forgive me. But in this dream, I said to Master, what can I do? I want to get your book out, but I don't have access to the archives. And he answered in my dream, don't overlook the possibility of a skylight. And years later, I was thinking that at least I should write what I can remember of the Bhagavad Gita, of what he wrote, which was so beautiful. And Jyotish and Devi were coming to India. And the day they were coming, I thought, I've got to get started or I'll never get started. And so I began writing it. And they came on October 7th. December 5th, I finished the entire book. What amazed me was that I remembered every single sloka. Not word for word, but thought for thought. I've written it as a book. It's called The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita. And many Indians have said this is the best Gita they have ever read. So do get that book. It's a great book.
I have
nothing to say about the authorship. I'm not the author. But every day I wrote 10 or 20 pages, and it's amazing. I only took 1 month editing it, which for me is extraordinary because I usually edit a long time, maybe a year. I'm very conscientious as a writer, but this took only 1 month. The whole book is just, it's a thrilling book. Do read it. Okay? Yes.
First of all, I want to say that I'm really delighted to see you here. This is the lady that Casey was speaking about at lunch today.
Okay.
And I'm so happy to meet you. And I wanted to ask you about this. In Gita, they always say, stay detached, but keep doing your duty.
What did you say?
In Gita, they always say, stay detached, but keep doing your duty.
Yes.
So what does that actually mean?
It means that whatever the outcome of your action, if you do the right thing, it will be right for you. I was doing my best to serve Master. I was thrown out. But it was the best thing possible. To be detached, nishkam karma, action without desire for the fruits of action, is necessary. If you have desire for one perfectly practical reason, if you have a desire for one particular outcome, then your energy is limited. And if you don't care about the fruits and just act well as you can for this moment, you'll find that the best you can do is what you will do. But if you're worried about the fruits, you're always thinking of the future. There's a very practical teaching. The wonderful thing about the Bhagavad Gita is that it's a thoroughly practical teaching on every level. It is not about warfare, and yet it can be about warfare. I mean, God is not lying. It's really about the war between your upward moving desire for aspirations for goodness and your downward habits, which take you back into matter. And okay, this is the book, yes.
The essence of the Bhagavad Gita, and get it or you're going to miss something great.
And so, what the Gita is telling is a very practical teaching. Don't be attached. Do it for God. Do it to please God. You will find that if there's no ego, ego is attachment. If there's no ego, there's joy in everything. So if you want to know joy, act without detachment. If you want to know God, act without detachment. If you want to know who you are, don't be attached to what you think you ought to be or what you imagine you are. Detachment is essential as a road to wisdom. Okay? Yes.
Continuing on the Bhagavad Gita.
What is that?
Continuing on the Gita.
When every person reads it, you know, a sentence or two grabs him or her. To me, it seemed like chapter 12, verse 54, around that verse, where he says the only, Sri Krishna says, the only way to see the cosmic form is through love, bhakti. And I was wondering if there's any one or two sentences which meant the most to you in the Gita.
He said, as people read the Gita, usually they're drawn to one or two sentences that really grab them. And for him, it was in chapter 12, where Krishna says the only way to know God is through bhakti, through love. And he was wondering if there's anything in particular that grabbed you in the detail.
I would say the devotion in the last chapter, 18th chapter, where he says, leave everything and love me, is the most beautiful. Nonetheless, the Gita teaches karma yoga, Jnana Yoga, all the different Vaya Yogas, it teaches the complete path. And in fact, the path that Yogananda brought was what he called the confluence of all these rivers into one big river. Because the river that we really have to follow is the river of the spine. A very interesting thing is that Sri Yukteswar, whom my guru called a Jnanavatar, he, in his book, The Holy Science, said that the first and most important thing is devotion, is love. If you live next door to the most famous French restaurant in the world, but you're never hungry, you'll never go in there. It's hunger that takes you in there. So to seek God, there has to be hunger for Him. It's not enough to be an armchair philosopher. You have to say that I must taste this for myself. I reached the point in my search for God where I was desperate. I thought maybe I'm going crazy. because I had never read about the lives of saints. I didn't know anything of Indian philosophy. I didn't know anything of Western religion. I had been seeking through science, through politics, through the arts, through all sorts of other ways. But I was desperate to know the truth. And when I finally realized, after a long walk I took into the countryside outside Charleston, South Carolina, where I was living at the time, and I asked myself, if there's a God, what must he be? I thought, well, what makes me ask this question? The fact that I'm conscious. Therefore, if nothing else, he has to be consciousness. And I have to be a part of that consciousness. And if I am clear-minded, I'm able to absorb more clarity. If I'm dull-minded, I absorb less. And therefore, what I must do is give my life to seeking God. And I determined that very night that my life would be lived to know him. And then the thought came to me, but are you going crazy? There's nobody in history that I knew of who had ever even thought of seeking God. It seemed like a ridiculous thing. Had anybody ever sought him? Had anybody found him? I wondered if I was actually losing my mind. And I remember trying to escape from this, to go up into the countryside of northern New York and just try to enjoy nature. I thought, maybe I'm just getting jaded by city life. And I found that, yes, I could see the beauty of the sunlight on the dewdrop, but I couldn't feel it. I said, I'm like a motor with only one cylinder. And I said, it's something in me that I have to change. And I just decided I had to know God. I was really desperate. If I was going crazy, okay, but I had to go crazy sincerely. And God arranged it that my father, who was very skeptical spiritually, that he was sent away to Cairo by his company. And the day that I put my mother on the ship to go join him, it was the day I found the autobiography of a yogi in a New York in the Uptown bookstore. I hadn't heard, I didn't know for Indian philosophy, but I'd read a little bit in a book of mothers, which was called A Short World Bible, little excerpt from different religions. And the Hindu religion really won my heart by two things. One is it emphasized experience. And the other is it didn't emphasize one particular person. It said we are all God. So these things really attracted me. And when I went into that bookstore, I saw the Bhagavad Gita, and I saw Autobiography of a Yogi. I was so drawn by the face on that cover that I bought the book. Not right away, but I bought the book. I read that he was a vegetarian. I had never even thought you could live without eating meat. But as soon as I read that, I said, all right, I'm a vegetarian. Give up eating meat. He was a monk. All right, I would be a monk. And I remember the first night people invited me to their home because my parents were overseas and I was alone there. And they gave me chicken a la king. Well, I was able to push the chicken to one side and eat the vegetable. But the next night, another friend invited me, and they gave me hamburger. Well, I couldn't take hamburger, so I had to reject it. And he also thoughtfully provided me with a date, and I just sat as far away from her as I could, because I said he was a monk, I would be a monk. And I when I finished that book, I took the next bus across the country, and that was when I met him. And another interesting thing that happened was that he said, it was on Sunday, September 12th, 1948, and he said that I'm not seeing you because you've come from so far. I'm seeing you because Divine Mother told me to. In another life, I wrote many songs to Divine Mother, and I believe that was the influence that she has guided my life. all these times. And I'll tell you another very interesting story. One time, after 10 years of absence from India, I felt guided by the Divine Mother, and I felt that she wanted me to go back to India. And I had just enough money to go and be there for a couple of months and then come back. And just 2 weeks before I was to leave, my car broke down. And I realized, living in the mountains as I did, that I needed a car. And so the dilemma in my mind was, shall I get the car? In which case, how will I go to India? But if I come back from India, which I have to do, then how will I move around? So I couldn't get any answer from God. I prayed to Divine Mother, I got no answer. And so finally I said, well, Divine Mother, my common sense tells me that I'll need a car when I get back. So I'll have to buy a new car, a new used car. And this was Friday night, I put $1,100 down on a good used car. Monday morning, I told Divine Mother, if you still want me to go to India, you're going to have to reimburse me. And Monday morning, I got a letter from somebody I didn't know. It contained a check for $1,000 addressed to me, and it said, use this as Divine Mother wants you to. I mean, how many people in this country think of God as their Divine Mother? But this letter said, use this money as Divine Mother wants you to. To me, that was one of the most beautiful manifestations of God's love. He is with you, he's your friend. He wants to help you. And I've seen again and again in my life that he has taken care of me. He's always with you if you were with him. Love is the most important thing. Jnana is nothing without love. Any other questions? Yes.
This is a praise report and a question.
A what?
A praise report and a question.
And I can talk louder. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Great. Okay. The last time you and I met, okay, was in Los Angeles.
Last time you met was in Los Angeles.
Yes.
You blessed me. And I asked you this question. We would be honored to have you to come to Ananda Encinitas.
I remember.
To you. And you said to me, my schedule's very busy. I don't know if that's possible. And I said to you, we'll pray for that moment and that day.
Well, that prayer was what brought me here.
And you said, be it God's will. And that's my praise report. Here you sit.
And I said, that's why I'm here.
Yes, thank you. Praise God. And question is this, how's your movie coming along?
Actually, I've written 2 or 3 movies. That's partly why I'm in Los Angeles. One is on the life of Master. I don't think Autobiography of a Yogi will ever be made into a movie. There's no plot to it. And another reason is that he doesn't talk about himself as he deserves to be talked about. He's always deprecating himself. It's beautiful. You know, Master said he was Arjuna. And in the life of Arjuna also, he presents himself in the Gita as just this humble little devotee. And our master in Autobiography of a Yogi presents himself as this humble seeker whom everybody could follow and do the same thing and achieve the same results. But he was a great avatar, a great master. And it takes that vision of him to write a movie that he deserves to have written about him. So I've written another movie called The Wayshower. And that is being in the process now. There's a lot of enthusiasm in Hollywood for producing it. And I think they'll have it out in some few months, I hope so. But they're working very hard on it and with great devotion. So that's one movie, The Wayshower. Another one I wrote about my coming to him. And for the moment, it's being changed into what they call a docudrama. And somebody, they're happy to have me do it because for the first time they found somebody who can be the subject of a docudrama who's still alive. So the point is, keep me alive long enough to finish the movie. But the idea is to show how in my search for truth I came to Yogananda and through him found what I was looking for. And then there's another movie that I've written, which I think in time will be made a movie. It's great fun. I'll tell you what happened. A few months ago, well actually it was still in India, I saw a copy somewhere on my shelf of The Wizard of Oz. And for some reason I felt idly curious to read this thing again, just for the fun of it. And I got as far as the Yellow Brick Road when all of a sudden this idea came to me to write a children's story. And I wrote this children's story and it just wrote itself. I wrote 180 pages in 2 weeks, which is just amazing. But it actually, it's great fun. And I'll tell you a little bit about the plot. It's me and my brother when we were children. And we used to visit, I was born and grew up in Romania, and we used to go down to a place called Timiș in the Transylvanian Alps for the summer. And we'd run out and play in the forest and go swimming in the local brook and so on. So I imagined going further into the forest and coming upon the ruin of a laboratory. And these children, these two boys, go there. And the first thing they notice is a dinosaur in the out the front there. And it's the skeleton of a dinosaur, mostly eaten away, but there's still some flesh on that dinosaur. How is this possible? And anyway, they go into a back room in this what was the ruin of a laboratory, and they find a hole in the wall. And they go through this hole, and it turns out to be a tunnel. And they go down and down and down. And they find themselves becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, until finally they're reduced to nothing. And suddenly this little bubble of egolessness forms around them as a bubble of light. And they come out into timelessness. So it's called the Tunnel of Light, the Time Tunnel. And they go into this and they find somebody there who had was lying on the ground, completely unconscious, and they called to him and finally they woke him up and they said something about that dinosaur. He was frightened to death. What had happened was that he and his father had built this laboratory to enable them to travel through time. And his father had warned him that there is, just as there is such a thing as the sound barrier, so there is also the time barrier. And if you go too quickly through time, then you can have it cause an explosion. And don't do it, because I don't know what terrible thing might happen. Anyway, this young man went back 64 million years ago to the time of the dinosaurs. And he was intrigued enough. When you're in your sphere of light, no one can hear you or see you. But when you come out of that, and the story tells you how to get into it and out of it, then you become a part of the scene. So he climbed on the back of this dinosaur, and he was enjoying himself looking around, and all of a sudden the Tyrannosaurus Rex came charging out to attack the dinosaur he was riding. He didn't bother about him, he was just a little ant. But he attacked this other dinosaur, and anything that you're holding, as he was gripping this dinosaur with his knees, you take with you. But when you time travel, and he got out of that time zone too quickly, and there was this explosion back at the time tunnel, and the dinosaur was thrown forward and he was thrown backward. It turned out he'd been lying there unconscious for 5 years, because in this zone there was no time. And so to him it was just like a matter of moments. But they explained that the dinosaur was dead. Apparently the explosion killed him, but didn't kill this man. Anyway, with the help of this man, they go backwards and forwards in time. And it's great fun. because it was all given to me as if on a platter, but many spiritual teachings I was able to give would be things that put in such a way that a child would enjoy them. And the idea of egolessness and everything. It's amazing how much deep philosophy I was able to bring out through this book. And they went back to Egypt, for example, and they discovered that the pyramid was not a tomb for Khufu. It was not even an initiation chamber. It was a place where priests and priestesses would go and lie down in that sarcophagus to which there's never been found a lid. And that then they would go into an ecstatic state, and the pyramid form gave power to their thoughts, and they would emanate blessings over the whole countryside. Well, to me that seemed very reasonable. So I was able in this book to say things that seemed to make a lot of sense, but I can't prove it, so I can't write in a serious book. But I could write in this book. Anyway, it was great fun. And then they went forward to another Satya Yuga, and they went forward to 1,000 years in the future and so on. And the book ends that this boy, whom they found, he meets a young girl there and decides he wants to stay. So he decides to stay, and the children go back and they promise to come back, but they can't because the World War comes and they're sent to America, and they could never get back to Romania and go back to that ruin and go backwards in time, none of that. But they said, well, they've never been back, but would you like to go? That's how the book ends. Anyway, it's great fun. So any other questions? Yes.
Thank you for gracing Encinitas with your presence. But I have to be curious. You mentioned a few times that you were thrown out of SRF. Do you know why?
I do know why. I think it was jealousy. But what they were saying was that I was doing things for my own glory. I was trying to get Master's show on the road, and they said, it's just your ego that's doing it, and we don't want your energy. And they made many, many accusations that were extremely harsh. I'm not going to bother to repeat them, but I've written a book called Rescuing Yogananda, in which I tell that story. Because I really desperately want to save his name from any reputation which has been growing of his harsh disciplinarian nature and his sternness and attitudes of his. He was the kindest human being I ever met. He was the most loving and lovable. And I want to present him that way. And I find that they're putting him out as this stern, authoritarian. I want to correct that impression. So, more questions? Okay. I think that's enough questions for tonight. For one thing, it's freezing cold. I'd like to ask God to bless all of you. Are you saying that? It's awfully cold. Would you like to come and ask for a blessing? If so, make it quick. Bold. I don't hear you. I'm left here.
Thank you, everybody.